You're listening to DVD Talk Radio.
The deep, handsome voice is Chris Sanders.
Chris Chase, producer.
Okay.
Are they different enough? If the voice is talking way too fast, it's me. Is Chris Sanders talking too fast?
Okay.
Yep, there.
So now, haven't you, you know, what are Stitch's components, vocal components? What are you thinking about?
I'd like to know that.
Well, you know something he was never intended to really, really ever talk. In the very beginning, we thought he was going to be a character of pure pantomime, just like Dumbo. And it wasn't until about halfway through the process we realized eventually he's going to have to make little noises of agreement, disagreement, pleasure, pain, something. And you didn't really want to call up a real actor and have them come in and go, no, no, Mr. Redford, we just want you to squeak and grunt. And that just wouldn't go. So temporarily, until we really figured out the problem, my co-director, Dean Debelaj, just said, you just do it. Just you do these voices. You call people on the phone and go, hello.
Are you hungry? I'm hungry. I want to go to lunch. Please, I want to go to lunch.
And I would just do that. And he's like, use that voice, because I would use it when I pitched the boards. And then it was later, still in the process, that he was actually going to have to deliver a couple of lines. And then I became very, very sort of tense about it, because I thought, okay, this was not the intention that I would end up doing this. So, but we had the same reservations. We were so late in the process. We thought, if we bring somebody else in, again, you'll just be telling them, well, we're doing it like this, and there'll be just too much history that they'd have to catch up on. And we said, Dean said, let's just see if you can pull it off. So we just went forward and saw if I could pull it off, and it worked.
And now you feel you're trapped doing Stitch's voice around the world.
I like it. I like it, yeah.
But it's not at all like animation, which is what you do.
Yeah, it's different, huh? It's not like acting, though. So
it's not like acting?
Well, no, because all he does is scream and fuss. And I do that, so that's easy.
Oh, you do that in the animation room.
Yeah, people who know me know.
Oh, he makes it sound so easy, but it was so great for us that we didn't really have to worry a lot about, you know, Stitch, because we could just go, how would he say that, Chris? He'd be like, Ichiban.
I would do this.
So you're the producer. Are you where the buck stops?
I'm supposed to be. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, what?
I'm supposed to be normally. Yeah.
Come on, let's do it. We gotta find a way to do it.
I mean, you had to. First of all, we've been told that you had limited time and limited budget, and you had to deal with Australians. From Australia.
Why'd she look at you?
Look, and she's got her card turned around, so we can't see it.
So what would you say was the hardest thing for you?
I think it's that Tony and Michael and myself all came from features. So we know how to make a large feature. It's what we've, had experience in what we do. And we love the original movie. I mean, that's kind of the pleasure of this. Sequels are tough, You don't always get original material that you instantly love, and this movie is really fun. So it was about I think even if you have $100 million, you feel like, it's not enough money.
Right.
You always want to do more stuff. So it became about kind of the endless journey of trying to get the maximum amount of goodies out of whatever time and space and money and people that you've got. And we actually thought we were really fortunate to work with Sydney. We were talking in another room about the fact that they are, the best 2D animation studio left in the world today. And boy, they did stuff for us that...
Not for much longer than...
Yeah, well, we've also been talking about this. We think 2D is going to cycle around. It's going through one of its phases. But good art and interesting stories, when they come together, somebody's going to do it. Everybody's going to get re-energized about 2D, and it'll all happen in its own time.
And just to mention, actually the original Lilo and Stitch had a lot of constraints budget-wise and time-wise as well.
It did.
Yeah, we that film was considerably smaller budget-wise, considerably smaller than the films that had come before it.
Yeah.
That was the whole idea of it was to make it on a Beauty and the Beast schedule and a Beauty and the Beast budget.
Chris, can you talk to us about Dakota?
Oh, yeah. Dakota was great. DeVay Chase, the original Lilo, was so wonderful and such a specific, wonderful sound. And she was just for us starting to get just a little bit too old. I mean, her voice was really starting to change. And I know that they were still using her in some of the other areas, but they were pitching her voice and doing things with it. And so we were worried, because this was 3 years ago. We thought, okay, 3 years from now, we'll be doing ADR and trying to do pickups and those kinds of things. And, gracious, she'll sound like, you know, a 20-year-old woman and we'll be in big trouble. And so at that time, Dakota, I guess she'd just done Uptown Girls and the camera. She was just so charming, so wonderful and charming, and had this kind of quirky little girl voice. And we sort of immediately responded. And then, you know, as over the course of 3 years that we're working with her, she kept doing, you know, movie after movie and, you know, Man on Fire and, you know, Cat in the Hat and all these kind of wonderful things that were all sort of terrific and different that we just got very excited. And she just, every time she came into the room, she brought something fun for us. So, which I imagine is about the same that you had with DeVay.
She knew the property, too.
She loved it.
Yeah, she was familiar with the original. Is that true?
Completely. Oh, yeah. She was crazy. Cool. Yeah, she was very... very excited about it. So it was like we were getting this actress who was already predisposed to love us. So it's kind of neat.
That's cool.
Does that answer your question?
Yeah, she's still going to be, it does, thank you. She's still going to be a part of the whole.
I think as long as she wants to be and her, you know, her voice allows. I mean, it's a tricky thing with our business that, you know, if they continue to make, you know, properties in this franchise, you kids grow up.
When you guys are auditioning voice talent, I know Walt had the women for Snow White come in and stand behind a screen so he couldn't see them. And that's how he found Snow White. How do you guys do it? Do you listen to tapes?
Yeah, it starts with, I mean, because it's voice talent, I mean, we can very sort of inexpensively go out to casting people all over the world and, you know, say, send us tape, or in this case they now have things like Voice Bank where it's all digital and you go on a website and you listen to people and you say, okay, these 10 sound really interesting to me, let's get more on them or let's meet with them, and then you kind of whittle it down and then you try something.
Wow, but that makes, I mean, it makes the pool so much larger.
It does, but you'd be surprised. It's interesting. We come back, all of that said, we come to Dakota, who's somebody who's very well known, and for a reason. It's all about acting chops and that ability to come into a room and do it not just one way, but 10 different ways until you find that perfect read, that perfect sort of take. Mm.
Who's the Elvis Presley fan out of all the people that have his music in there?
It really started with the very first treatment. As I was pitching the actual idea before anybody had seen it in the studio, I went to Palm Springs and spent a long week. I just locked myself in a hotel room and finished the very first treatment. And when it came time to create traits for Lilo, I just threw in Elvis Presley because it's somebody I really like. And I actually didn't think it would go on beyond that. I thought, oh, that's a great thing. It'll color and it'll establish her character. But it won't go beyond that. People who will read it will go, okay, I really get this little girl and stuff. But then it took on a life of its own. And my co-director, Dean Deblo, was like, well, we should do sequences around Elvis songs. I'm like, well, I didn't really mean it for it. I don't want to push my preferences to that point where you're like, well, I want Elvis, so it's going to be all Elvis and stuff like that. But his music was so likable, and the idea was it caught on, and so it wasn't really needed to push it beyond that. It was my co-director and Chris Montana, they really picked up on that, and it became a really established thing in the movie. Which is
and the funny part is, for Tony and Michael, in their first pass of the movie, they were thinking, okay, we'll do something different and we'll back away, because Elvis has been done in this movie as a sort of thematic idea.
You can't escape Elvis.
Well, the funny part is that you can't. Like, all of a sudden, you're at certain moments in your movie and you want that energy and that incredible sort of fun likability, and it became very easy to kind of go back to that, and then it turned out the answer was lots of Elvis. You know?
His gravitational field is too strong.
Yes, exactly.
You know, the king.
She'll be pulled in.
The king,
you know.
Yeah.
So why didn't you direct this one?
I was banned. No, you know something? They didn't really exactly start and stop. These guys were actually looking and developing the sequel before we released the original film. Because I think that we want, if it really hit, if it captured people's imagination, you didn't want to wait too long to get everything started, so it was actually begun beforehand.
Creatively, were you heavily involved in the sequel?
No, that's the exciting part, is that we were called in before our film released, and these guys had already begun writing and boarding. And there's that moment you're like, oh, I didn't do this sequence, I didn't have anything to do with it, and you. I don't think it was nervousness exactly. It was a little bit exciting, but they showed us, and it was right on the money. And the most important thing was, character-wise, it was right on the money, but it wasn't safe. They didn't, you know, sort of, you know, contain it. Like, well, maybe they won't be happy, or maybe the characters wouldn't do this. They didn't question it. They used the characters, and they were very bold with them. And that was when I felt really safe, was that the characters were being, I guess, in a sense, not safe.
And Chris and Dean were really generous with their time. I mean, he downplays it, and it certainly was Tony and Michael's movie, but they were available to us, and it was great. It was kind of like, so often when you work on Disney sequels, everybody's dead, you know. You know what I mean? Like, it's they've been done long ago, and you have to be, either go back to the archives and hope you find some sort of artwork that inspires you, or stories, or apocryphal stories about how it was done, but you just don't have it. And these guys came over quite a bit, and you know, would Lilo do this, or would Stitch do that?
And the whole thing was fresh and unprecious.
Yeah.
They'd call us up, we're doing this. Very good.
Do you hate it? We don't hate it.
You go right ahead.
So is 3 in the works?
You know, I have no idea, actually. I would assume that if this movie does well, the studio will want to pursue another one. I'm certainly not part of it, but...
Declined to comment, citing pure retaliation.
No, I mean, you know,
the way you first said it sounded like it might be going on now. We just don't know about it. We're not sure.
Well, that's kind of the way I feel. I mean, I'm not working for that division right now. But they usually are developing story ideas all the time. And I suppose if it sells tons of units, yes. I mean, I bet you money they'll do another one.
What was you guys' involvement in the extras on the disc?
Do you mean, like, specifically they asked us for ideas, and then they did whatever they wanted to.
Is that true? That was Chris Chase. That wasn't Chris Sanders. Chris Chase said that. Not Chris Sanders.
The big idea, the one about the creation of Stitch, was actually an idea that Tony and Michael had written into this movie, and we never were able to produce it. It was cut for story purposes and time and all kinds of other things, and everybody loved that idea, like, how was Stitch created? And so then another group of animators came in and did that little piece for it.
So if Elvis kind of defines Lilo's character or her energy, who defines Stitch?
Unfortunately, it might be me. People who saw it think that he acts like me.
Can you imagine?
Yes. So, yeah.
Because I think the neat thing about Stitch is that he's he landed... And I didn't know this at the time, and it wasn't until after it released, and I really got a good look at it, I got a perspective on it, is that he landed in between these worlds of villains and heroes in Disney films. Characters in Disney films are very, very clearly defined, and they're very strongly defined, and he actually lands kind of in the middle. So if a bunch of nice Disney characters had a party, they probably wouldn't invite him, and if villains had a party... they wouldn't invite him either. They don't want him there either. So I think that he's like us. I think that he is basically a good character. He tries, but he misunderstands things and he fails at things. And he's ruled by his really simple sort of childish urges. If he doesn't want to do something, he doesn't want to do it. And he'll scream and squeal and fuss and we would like to do that. So I think he's very much like that.
But it says that the very first idea for Stitch came from you, from your wild imaginings. Tell us a little bit about that.
Your mouth, you're raving.
About that experience.
Did
I mean,
it say that?
Know,
wild?
No, it
okay.
Didn't. I was paraphrasing.
Oh, okay.
were you drinking coffee? When did it come to you?
Here's the leading question.
It has a long, weird history that back in 1985, I was actually working in another studio. It was my very first job at Marvel Productions, and I wanted to do a children's book outside of work, and I created this very elaborate story, and at the center of it was this little sort of monster demon thing, and I almost immediately abandoned the idea of doing this book because I realized the idea was too subtle and too big to fit into, say, 24 pages. So I liked the character that I came up with, but I really didn't have anything I could do with him, and I realized that the only way he would really work out is on screen, and I certainly hadn't the means to do that, so I just put him on a shelf, and it wasn't until 19 years later that I was asked... after finishing Mulan, is there any story that I would like to tell or develop? And I remembered that little character, and I thought, yeah, there is. So he sort of got pulled out of the shelf and dusted off and then developed beyond where he was.
Mm. Are you guys still with Disney?
Yes, actually, just not with the same division.
Not with the same division.
Yeah.
Okay, has there been any effect on your department from the machinations from above?
In what way?
Well, a change of management. And
you mean the Michael Eisner and all that
mm-hmm.
stuff? You know, we hear about it constantly, and people speculate about it all the time. But it's so far removed from our day to day that I don't know about you, but I don't really feel it. specific.
Yeah. Not directly. I mean,
not to say that there won't
be
more to come.
Time would change things, yeah. But it's not one of those things that, yeah.
Yeah, I don't think, you know, say Bob Iger's really been in charge long enough to have a big change, of course, but it'll happen.
Well, it worries me because I go way back to, you know, when Roy Disney headed the thing. And I went through all that big fight and when they made the Black Cauldron that bombed and all that. I've been through all that with you guys.
Wow.
So I keep wondering, what's going to happen now? Because I've always supported animation the way Roy did. And so I'm just, when I see the changeover, I just wonder if it's going to affect you.
I think that one of the things you have to remember, too, is that there are so many people in animation that it has, how do you say this? Everybody loves it so that works on it, and there's a big enough group of people that are working on it that you couldn't walk in and just suddenly change that. The sensibilities remain the same, and the people remain the same. So the projects will have a certain momentum and direction that wouldn't suddenly change. And I don't think anybody really wants to change that.
Oh, good.
I think that yeah, nothing like that would. You can't really redirect that.
It's true. Most of the people at Disney are there because they really like the history of it and the culture of it, and you know they hope it keeps changing for the better. That's not to segue back into Lilo and Stitch, but I think that was kind of one of the nice things was it's a piece that felt like a Disney piece, but brand new, something we hadn't necessarily done before. And I hope that Disney can keep, whatever the culture is, I hope it can keep doing that, keep true to its roots, but also, you know, find that new sort of interesting offbeat thing.
How does direct-to-video stuff, direct-to-DVD stuff fit into that? Do you feel more pressure or less pressure doing a directed?
Well, as I'm sure the previous group said to you, I mean, there's definitely a difference in schedule and money. I mean, it has been. Not to say that it will always be so, because the more I read right now, the more it sounds to me like DVD is becoming sort of a financial equivalent in many ways to domestic box office. And I think we'll see how that plays out over time.
You've been listening to DVD Talk Radio. Find DVD Talk Radio online at dvdtalkradio.com.